Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/EMSradio. Over 85,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player.
You've tuned in to the PDU Podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The PDU Podcast brings together industry experts and seasoned professionals to discuss topics in the assessment and management of the pediatric patient in the out-of-hospital environment. You can interact with us at pd-u.com, on Twitter at PDU, email us at podcast@pd-u.com, or call us at 716-245-5336.
Hello and welcome to the PDU Podcast. My name is Kyle David Bates, and this is your bi-weekly podcast on dealing with everything, well, small and whiny and crying and cranky and less than 2 months of age, and Dr. Lou's going to yell at me for that one. This is our special holiday version of the Pediatric Podcast. It's going to be a small one with Dr. Lou and myself, and we're going to talk about the holidays. Dr. Lou, how are you tonight?
I am doing great in nice, warm Florida. Finally, our cold snap went away, and instead of being 27 today, it was 72.
I'd be happy with 27. It's been about 14, 15 degrees up here in Buffalo area, and I got about a foot of snow, and they're reporting lake effects are moving in tonight, so I'll wake up to having to shovel the driveway.
Okay, come on down. I got a spare room.
I like the cold. It's something about it. I don't know. It's refreshing.
I like to visit it.
Yeah, I hate sweating. That's the thing.
Yeah, me too, and I live in Florida.
You know, and you're sitting over there, and you're holding a head or doing an airway management, and you've got that one bead of drop of sweat on your nose.
Been there.
And it's going right to their forehead. You know where that's going.
Yeah, been there.
So this is the special holiday version.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Yes, definitely happy holidays. And formerly, happy Hanukkah. We tried to have Dr. Antevi come on. Unfortunately, he's off tonight taking care of kids in the hospital. So he's not able to join us today. But we wanted to kind of look at pediatrics from a holiday version and illnesses and injuries that you may encounter during this season. And when I was emailing out the topics to our various panel, Dr. Lou kind of wrote back, you know, about poinsettias and chewing on glass ornament bulbs, and I kind of chuckled because the way I was going to start off the podcast, like I always do, is telling a personal story. And yes, you know, my sister is probably going to kill me, but when my sister was about 3 years of age, we had come back from church on Christmas night, and we came into the living room. It was dark, and she's crying. And just crying and crying, and we turn the lights on, there's blood coming from her mouth, and in her hand is a glass Christmas ornament. Of course, parents, everyone freak out. I'm just a kid this time, so everyone's, you know, running around, you know, scared, and they end up going to the hospital. So, Dr. Lou, it's kind of funny that you brought that up. You know, I don't know if that was kind of tongue-in-cheek as you did that, but it really did happen to my sister.
And it happens every year. As a matter of fact, we've had at least our very first one of the season so far this year.
Already?
Yep.
What is it with these kids? I mean, you know, does it like attract them, or what's the big...
Well, number one, at certain ages, they're just fearless, so they don't know that there's... And number two, you know, they just rejoice in exploring the world. So if it's something that's shiny or makes a noise or is a pretty bright color, they just want to investigate, and they use all of their senses. So, you know, they taste things as well as smelling them and touching them and all that kind of stuff.
Sounds like some of my partners that I've had.
Well, that's another show, I think.
These kids like to explore these things with their mouths. But is there much that we have to worry about on these, or is this just a lot of superficial injury?
Well, if you're talking about things like the Christmas ornaments, it's just amazing what people can eat that the body can deal with and suffer no trouble whatsoever. So, yeah, even the glass Christmas ornaments, for the most part, you know, as long as they're in relatively small pieces, yeah, they pass through without any kind of problem whatsoever. So, you know, kids that put inanimate objects in their mouths, you know, the general rule of thumb is this too shall pass. At least that's what we say in the ER.
Oh, Now, you know, if we're there, most likely we're going to be dealing with some oral trauma. What would be the best way to control the bleeding, you know, on these kids? Or should we not even worry about that?
Usually it's not even worth worrying about. The kid may be spitting up a little bit of blood, but you'd be surprised at how little intraoral trauma there is, even with these glass ornaments. I don't know. It's God made people really, really in a smart fashion, and the body just can tolerate a heck of a lot. But, you know, if you have a kid who's just having some pain and a little bit of oozing from the mouth and they don't seem to have any other problems, you could even try, just having them drink something cold.
Okay, to actually cause some vasoconstriction and stop bleeding, you think? Okay.
And pain, you know, help and with pain? Any pain as well, sure. Absolutely. As long as you're certain that, you know, they're not going to throw up, their airway's not compromised and that kind of thing. You know, most of the thing is just symptomatic treatment, unless you have somebody who has a bleeding problem, and it would not be a hemophiliac. It would be someone who had more like mucosal bleeding, so someone with a disease called von Willebrand's disease, or someone who has low platelets from chemotherapy or some kind of ongoing disease. It really should just be a minor consideration.
So basically, if we're dealing with a child with special health care needs, that's when we have to be a little bit more concerned then.
Possibly there, not because of problems with bleeding, but maybe even more with problems with swallowing coordination, because many children with certain kinds of special health care needs may not be able to be fed orally for everything because they may have trouble with coordinating their swallowing and having reflux and aspiration and that kind of thing. But you know very well, if you've had a big bolus of something that you haven't chewed up and it kind of gets stuck back there, you know, it takes a little bit of coordination to kind of relax and finally let it go down. And the kids who have incoordination of swallowing may not be able to do that, and they might have more chance of actually choking on it and coughing it back up and having it go down the wrong pipe.
Ooh. Yeah.
Which is never a good thing.
Never a good thing. Now, we're always, a lot of times in EMS, parents will look at us and say, well, do we need to go to the emergency room?
Mm-hmm.
What would be our, I mean, you know, if we go from the litigation side, yes, everybody has to go to the ER. You know, that's
right.
Kind of our role. But is that really always the practical thing? And do they always need to go by ambulance for this?
No, it is not always a practical thing. And no, by no means do they all have to go by ambulance. Protocols aside, medical legal stuff aside, if you're talking strictly about kids who put things in their mouths, and we're not talking about potential medications or chemicals, then if we're talking about just putting objects in their mouths, and let's exclude some plant material because plants can certainly have some significant effects when they're ingested, but let's say a toy soldier, a coin, even something like a thumbtack, you'd be surprised how many really pointy, sharp objects really do go through just absolutely fine. You know, if the parents suspect or they witnessed or the child said that they, you know, swallowed something like that, there was never any difficulty breathing, no choking, no vomiting, no complaint of pain in the throat, pain in the chest, anything like that, then probably they don't need to go by ambulance to the ER, and they might not even need to go to the ER at all.
At least follow up with their pediatrician?
Yeah, they should probably give the pediatrician a call, and depending on what time of the day it is, what day of the week it is, perhaps they could be seen by the pediatrician still that day. But most of the time, unless it's a symptomatic ingestion, there usually isn't anything that has to go on. And certainly we don't go snatching most things out of kids' GI tracts. We tend to let them pass. But there are a few specific exceptions to that rule.
I think that's a good lead-in. What would be our next exception?
I thought that would be a good lead-in. Well, three that I can think of right offhand. Fairly large objects, and just in prepping a little bit for the session today, I found a general rule of thumb that in a relatively small kid, less than about, say, early school age years, if an object is greater than about 6 centimeters long or 2 centimeters wide, so it's a little less than an inch wide and about 2.5 inches long, if it's either of those diameters bigger than that, then there's a very good chance that it's not going to be able to pass from the stomach through the pylorus, which is the channel that joins the stomach to the intestines. It's not going to be able to fit through the pylorus, which is the narrowest part of the upper GI tract. And if it can't pass through the pylorus, then it's going to stay in the stomach. And it's going to have to come out going up rather than going down. So large, relatively large objects.
What size objects do these kids put in their mouth to be that large?
It's usually not that big. I can't say that I've seen an ingested foreign body that's been that big for a long time. That's just a general rule of thumb, and come to think of it, that is just about the size of your thumb.
Hey, look at that.
Hey, how about
that's a
that?
Big, well, our thumb or their thumb?
No, our thumb.
Our thumb, that's a big honking piece.
But again, you'd be surprised, and it's the preteens and sometimes the teenagers that, they'll just be chewing on something and not paying attention, and they've swallowed it.
Pen cap.
Very rarely. Yeah, exactly, that kind of thing. Pen caps usually go through without any problem. We see those on a relatively frequent basis. But anything that's relatively large to that degree might have trouble working its way out of the stomach. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to be snatched right away. Generally, at that point, you'll show signs of probably some obstruction as the object kind of knocks up against the pylorus and kind of obstructs the channel, in which case then the child would generally show up with vomiting, the inability to tolerate any PO feeds. But that's relatively infrequent. Of a little bit more concern are disc batteries and then paired magnets. Okay. Regular batteries, I've not heard of kids swallowing the regular, like AA batteries, AAA batteries. It certainly can happen. They tend not to cause problems from everything that I've seen, and I certainly don't remember ever seeing one. But the disc batteries, hearing aid batteries and the ones that just seem to be in all kinds of electronic gadgets these days, can cause problems. Not as many problems as what we originally thought, though. It used to be thought that any kid that swallowed a disc battery, you need to go in there and get it out because the stomach acid or the acid period in the GI tract can erode the battery, and there are corrosive chemicals inside the battery, which then can cause ulcerations in the GI tract and potential perforation of the GI tract. More recent studies have shown that if the battery gets into the stomach itself and then gets out of the stomach going into the intestines, it should be fine and it generally is just going to pass on its own. However, if when it's found that battery is stuck in the esophagus, that's when you absolutely have to go in and get it. Because in the esophagus, it is going to be more exposed to stomach acid. It's going to splash up in the esophagus. The esophagus is relatively soft tissue, and if that battery does start to leak those corrosive chemicals, then it is very easy to erode through the wall of the esophagus, cause a perforation, and then you can get a mediastinitis or a chemical irritation and inflammation of the entire mediastinum, which, of course, is where the heart lives, and that can be deadly.
How long does it take for that to actually occur?
From what I was seeing, it looks like 2 hours is about the time where you start thinking that you need to go in and get it, 2 hours from the time of ingestion. I don't know that. I think that's probably just about the time when the chemical changes would start, not the time when injury would necessarily start. But we're talking hours. We're not talking days.
Now, in terms of how would you, besides actually seeing the kid put that in his mouth, on those, what might be some clues that maybe there was an ingestion of this type of object?
A lot of times the kids will tell you, or one of their siblings or one of their friends will tattle on them, because the great majority of kids, when they eat something, they're not symptomatic. Now, one of the exceptions to that is coins. That's the most commonly ingested foreign object that causes any kind of trouble, and it's generally a quarter. A child will swallow a quarter, and then the quarter will get stuck at the thoracic inlet or right, at the top of the rib cage in the esophagus at that level, just because that's the narrowest part of the esophagus. And in that case, the child is generally drooling, refusing to swallow. They can't handle their own secretions. They may complain of some pain in their neck or their chest because it is sort of blocking up the esophageal passage there. So if you have that kind of a presentation, and it's an acute onset, you don't have any other reason to explain why the kid is drooling and complaining of pain when he swallows, then that's a lodged foreign body until proven otherwise. Otherwise, generally, the kids will just come and they'll tell their parents, or somebody will tell the parents, oh, he put something in his mouth and you know, and he swallowed it.
Now, that brought up a real good point, because, you know, I think the one thing in terms of dealing with children of that type is gathering a quick history of is this a illness-related problem, or is this a foreign body aspiration? What would be some of the major differences in terms of our history, in terms of determining if this is a pathology, you know, versus a foreign body?
Number one would be the onset of symptoms. If the kid's been, you know, having some cold symptoms and just has sort of been kind of gradually becoming symptomatic, then it's more likely to be a medical problem. If the kid was perfectly fine, then just like flipping a switch, all of a sudden he's symptomatic. That's a big clue there. An age, you know, a 6-month-old is not getting around enough, really, generally, to be able to get into things and pick them up and put them in their mouth. But once you get to be the age where they're really getting around crawling and even walking, they're much more likely to get into something on the floor, pick it up, put it in their mouth. So age groups, anywhere from, oh, maybe 8 or 9 months on, is more at risk of doing that kind of thing. And of course, the younger ones will do it and then not be able to give you any history because they're not talking at that stage yet. And then the other risk factor would be, you know, look at the environment. Was the child found in a place where there's a lot of stuff on the floor? Or ask the parent, you know, has there been anything on the floor that he or she may have been able to pick up? Now, usually the parents will say no, but sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I remember seeing that there was something on the floor, you know, a pill bottle cap or something like that. I know it was there and I don't see it now. And it's not always on the floor. It could be on a table or something like that. So observation of the environment and questioning about potential objects that were in the environment can be a clue as well.
Now we're also in the season where there's a lot of home cooking. My wife begins to make soups for the holidays, and she uses a lot of these dried beans.
Yeah,
the real small ones. Mm-hmm. And those become a factor too, especially if they're aspirated.
Oh well, anything that's aspirated can be a problem, but any kind of vegetable matter, if it gets lodged in a moist place, can then swell. So if, let's say, a bean in the nose, a dried bean in the nose, you know, over time, that's just going to swell up. And as it swells up, just because of the secretions in the nose, you know, giving it moisture and making it puff up, then it obviously takes up more space, causes more obstruction, causes more symptoms, and is actually harder to take out as well. And that goes for things in ears, things, you know, things in any kind of orifice can. No, let's not go there.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, definitely, you know, the foreign bodies. But also, as we have these holiday seasons, we start to bring up more plants. Poinsettias are out there. Is it a fallacy that they're poisonous to kids? Is it?
We have good news for the plant lovers. It is false. Poinsettias do have some chemicals in them that are local mucosal irritants. Okay, so it's kind of like eating a philodendron. A philodendron has oxalic acid crystals, which is what's in spinach that gives you that squeaky sensation on your teeth. Poinsettias have similar kinds of irritative chemicals in the stems, in the roots, in the leaves, but not in the bracts, which the flower of the poinsettia. The red stuff is actually the bracts, it's not the flower, but that part is not toxic. We can put that one to bed. It's pretty well been conclusively proven that poinsettias are not toxic, may cause just a little bit of localized irritation, but that's it. Now, for those who like a little bit of mistletoe can potentially be toxic, but it takes quite a bit. Now, from what I could see, mistletoe berries, you have to eat at least 20 of the mistletoe berries, which are the little white berries, or five, if you're eating the berries, you're probably not kissing somebody, but 5 leaves or 20 berries seems to be the threshold there for starting to have any kind of toxic effects. And again, even if you do have the toxic effects, it's mostly gastric irritation, so, you know, burning, abdominal pain, oral pain, vomiting, diarrhea, that kind of thing.
What's the onset of symptoms with these
Most of those are going to be pretty, because they're just topical toxins or irritants. It's pretty quick. Okay. Pretty quick in onset after the ingestion. Hollies, now holly berries and parts of the holly plants are reputed to be a problem during the holiday season. But it turns out that there's much, much variation in the amount of poisonous compounds in the different varieties of holly. I think I saw that there were something like 400 different kinds of holly. Not all of them have poisonous compounds, but from what I saw, the ones that do have toxic properties to them, you generally need, again, to eat about 20 of the holly berries before you start getting into any kind of problems. And again, still mostly local irritation, but interesting to know what the toxin is in the holly berries. It's theobromine, which is a chemical relative of caffeine.
Oh, wow. So we got a kid who's sick and puking and running off the ceiling.
Yeah, yeah, and bouncing off the walls. Yeah, exactly. Boy, that sounds like a lot of fun. And then have you ever seen Jerusalem cherry? That's another one that's it's not down south here, but I hear that it is a relatively frequent Christmas decoration. They tend to like these berries, these glossy berries for holiday decorations, but Jerusalem cherries have slightly bigger red berries than the mistletoe and holly berries, and they can be very, very bad because Jerusalem cherry is in the nightshade family, which is, that's a deadly poison, and the poison is called solanocapsine, and it can cause either CNS depression or agitation and seizures, respiratory depression, bradycardia, bad GI symptoms, and death. So keep Jerusalem cherries out of the way of children.
So basically, excluding the Jerusalem berries, we're getting, you know, a lot of times what we're going to see is just some basic GI discomfort, distress, nothing really major. They should probably still be evaluated.
They should, particularly for those particular ones that have local irritation, then look inside the mouth, see if there's swelling inside the mouth, swelling of the lips that might, you know, cause any kind of airway obstruction. But that's about it. And it seems like these things don't really taste that good. So to get 20 of those berries down, probably the kid would be distracted by something else before they would get to that point, unless they're intentionally trying to do that.
So BLS treatment for these ingestions?
So observation and get them someplace in case anything bad happens. Really isn't any treatment.
Should we rinse out the mouth at all? Have them rinse with water at all?
Not a bad idea.
Okay. What about ALS treatment? Should we hold off on any like Zofran or anything like that? Let them vomit and get it out, or should we control that? Or
things are probably, as if they were chewed. Now, if they're not chewed, they probably aren't very irritating, and they can go down into the stomach and then just be digested in the stomach. If they're chewed, then that irritation is going to happen very, very quickly. And allowing them to vomit really isn't going to help anything as far as decontaminating and getting rid of the poisoning. So if you do have the option of giving an antiemetic such as Zofran or Ondansetron, which is the generic name, I would go ahead and give it if the patient is vomiting, because the potential of complications of the airway from the vomiting is greater than the potential of you know, complications from, you know, not from not getting that stuff out of the GI system.
With the irritation and such, on a more advanced case, would something like Benadryl or steroids be effective?
No. Benadryl probably is not going to be effective at all. It just is a completely different chemical process, and steroids aren't going to work for 3 or 4 hours. So it's certainly not going to help anybody in the pre-hospital setting. And in general, they're just not used even in the hospital setting for these kind of ingestions.
Okay. All right.
Now, another big one is alcohol.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know, you have your little Christmas party. It's been a long day. People's drinks are still sitting around. You don't want to clean up. You'll say, I'll get it in the morning. And junior or juniorette says, I'll help. And goes around and, you know, partakes of the leftover drinks.
We actually had a 2-year-old several years ago. I had Buffalo Flare come running out with an unconscious. And this is actually, I use my PAT. It's one of my first uses of the pediatric assessment triangle. And he comes running out with his limp kid in his hands. I'm like, right there, appearance. That's definitely not right. Okay, got that one done. breathing. Breathing was fine. There's no retractions, no flaring, no audible sound, no positioning. Skin was pink, warm, and dry. So I'm looking at the kid going, okay, we have an altered appearance. Mm-hmm. And started working down through my AEIOU tips. And the hard part is they brought him out to us. I'm like, okay, alcohol. Was he around anything? He goes, I don't think so. All right. So we went ahead and kind of put that one to a side. AE, epilepsy. Any history of seizures, Grandma? No. There's no history of seizures. AEIIOU, insulin. All right. Let's do a D-stick. Uh-huh. Crossing our fingers and came up 20.
I was going to say 30-something.
So we're like, all right. So we got the line and went ahead and treated the hypoglycemia with some dextrose. He woke up. He looks at me and smiles, wraps his arms around my neck, and I'm like, oh, it's just so cute. And yeah, don't get too happy about it because he wasn't glad to see me. The kid was lit. The kid was drunk.
Uh-huh.
And we really didn't find out because we didn't get the chance to talk to Grandma that much because she's in the front of the ambulance. And it took the ER at Children's Hospital a while to figure this out. They started talking to her, and as they got closer, they smelled a faint smell of alcohol. And when they did some more investigation, they found out that she had left out her rum and coke.
Mm-hmm.
And he got into it and just bottomed out of sugar with that.
Mm-hmm. And that is the difference between kids and adults and how they deal with alcohol. Adults generally don't get the degree of hypoglycemia with alcohol that kids do. So the primary threat to a kid with a typical, if there is any typical alcohol intoxication in a kid, the primary threat is going to be that hypoglycemia, unless they're alcohol poison, in which case then you have the CNS depression, respiratory depression, etc. But generally the biggest thing to watch out for the kids who've gone around cleaning up the drinks is hypoglycemia. Now, don't forget that it's not just the obvious alcohol. It's also perfumes, colognes are alcohol-based. Not so much medications anymore. You know, it used to be that NyQuil and some of the other kind of liquid cold medications, a lot of what really made you feel better was the alcohol in the preparations. But that's all been taken out. So there are some other things around that may cause an alcohol ingestion in a kid who just decides to up his mother's very expensive bottle of perfume. But at this time of the year, it's more the alcohol from leftover from the parties.
I think we should just take a quick minute and just review the treatment of hypoglycemia of kids and especially the dosing, because the one thing is, you know, I use my, you know, my Brazil tape and my length-based tape. I pulled it out and it said give 6 grams of dextrose.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate doing math.
I know. Here's an easy way to do it. First of all, the dose is 0.5 to 1 gram per kilo. Okay, so let's go at the lower end of that dose. If you have D50, you're going to start from D50. Divide D50 by 50. That equals 1. So if you have D50, it's 1 cc per kilo or 1 ml per kilo equals 0.5 gram per kilo. Okay, if you have D25, you divide the number 50 by the concentration, 25, and you get 2 mLs per kilo for the 0.5 gram per kilo dose. See where I'm going with this? So 50 divided by the concentration of what you're using equals the number of mLs. So if you make D12.5, then how many mLs do you need?
D12.5?
50 divided by?
Oh my god.
D12.5.
D12.5. You asked me to do math. D12.5. 50.
Even is 4, right? So if you have D10.
5.
5 mLs, isn't that so easy?
I love that one.
I love that. Once I learned that just because I used to do the same thing. Now, keep in mind that you don't necessarily have to have D25 or D10 right there with you. You can take your D50, take 1 ml of D50, and let's say you don't want to give D50 to a 1-year-old. You know, to a 1-year-old, you'd preferably like to do D12.5 or D25, just because your vein may not be large enough to handle that kind of tonicity. So you want to go with lower concentrations. Well, if you have D50, then you know you draw up 1 ml per kilo of the D50 and mix it with an equal amount of saline, and you have D25.
There you go.
There you go. So you can dilute whatever you want. And the reason I say D12.5 is because it's a division. You can dilute D50 down to D12.5 pretty easily.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Now, we're starting to see a little bit more push. It seems like, especially in the adult world, we're getting away, or there's some there's a school of thought of getting away from D50 and going into more D10 in terms of a little bit easier on the veins.
Yeah.
And the patients. Yeah. Are we seeing that as well in kids?
We always have gone with lower concentrations just because we do know that the veins are a little bit more fragile. So I think in this case, adult care is lagging behind pediatric care.
Now, you can look at that, and some people will say, well, if I'm going to give them D10, I'm going to give them a lot more fluid as opposed to the D50.
Yeah, but, you know, considering that we give 20 mLs per kilo as a bolus of isotonic fluids, if you're giving D10, that's 5 mLs per kilo, that would be your glucose bolus, that's nothing. In a healthy kid, they're going to be able to, their kidneys are going to be able to handle that with no problem.
Now, what happens if this kid was drinking his rum and coke at the top of a ladder, fell off and had a head injury as well as his hypoglycemia? Should we still be giving him his dextrose?
Yes.
Okay, so go ahead and treat that dextrose. Don't hold off.
Yeah, because keep in mind that, you know, we've gone away from the don't give fluids to people with head injuries kind of theory because, you know, we don't want to increase the intracerebral pressure to, you know, the theory about just maintaining adequate perfusion pressure. If they've got a significant head injury, then, you know, chances are their perfusion pressure may be even a little bit on the low side. Not that giving D10 is going to stay in the intravascular space that long. That's probably the real reason, is it's going to just leak out of the blood vessels pretty quick. It's not going to contribute to any swelling up there in the brain. But hypoglycemia could probably kill that kid faster than the head injury could.
Very good. And I think
so it's all relative.
Yeah, that's one thing I run into a lot in terms of teaching. About that, people are very, or even not even teaching, just in terms of the real world, people are very hesitant in treating hypoglycemia on head injured patients. For that, I always say the same thing. You know, the hypoglycemia is going to fry their brain a lot more than what the head injury.
Yeah.
The head injury is a maybe. The hypoglycemia.
Well, the brain needs fuel too.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the brain needs oxygen. Brain needs to get some carbon dioxide taken away, but it needs glucose too.
Absolutely.
So you're only worsening the head injury if you're not giving glucose to the brain.
There you go. For you, the listeners of the PDU podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. This is a great website, folks. Go over to it. And if you go to audibletrial.com, audibletrial.com/EMS radio, you can get a free trial for that. And Dr. Liu, we were just talking about the books on there. It's amazing how many books are on there.
Yeah, we were just looking at the list and it's like, oh, I like that author and I like that author and wow, you know, there's a lot of stuff here.
Even Brian Bledsoe had one on there. His books, his paramedic series is actually, he's got notes on there. So if you want to go over to that. Any books on there that kind of piqued your interest, Dr. Liu?
Well, yeah, you know, I'm a Jeffrey Deaver fan. I love to read forensic novels. So Lincoln Rhyme as the forensic detective is one of my favorites. So just recently going on the Burning Wire, which was one of the later of Jeffrey Deaver's novels. And it's on the website there. And I think it's a really cool novel. So encourage you to check it out if you like that kind of thing.
Oh, please do. Folks, there's over 85,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player. So to download your free audiobook, go today to audibletrial.com/EMS radio. Again, it's audibletrial.com/EMS radio. And give it a try. All right, so we've got the ingestions. Any other ingestions that we should worry about during the holiday season?
There is one other object that we need to be very, very wary of, and that's paired magnets. So two little magnets that click together and they stick together. Okay, they can be in all kinds of toys and stuff like that. There are earrings now that stay on by magnet. I had a little holiday pin that, you know, stays on by a magnet through the clothing. If somebody ingests paired magnets like that, there is a potential if those magnets get separated for one magnet to be in one part of the intestine and the other magnet to be in a close but different part of the intestine. And then the two magnets get close to each other and they stick together. But what they're doing is now they're sticking these two loops of intestine together and not letting them move and potentially causing trauma to the intestinal wall and causing erosion and perforation of the intestines.
Oh, that sounds kind of bad.
It is bad.
Now, again, you know, history is going to be that they ingested these, but what would be some signs that maybe we don't have, you know, the history that the kid did this?
Yeah, what you know,
things we run into.
That unless somebody sees it happen or the kid reports that they swallow this kind of thing, this is going to be one of those sneaky things that's going to sneak up probably a day or so later. As with almost any kind of perforation of the intestines, it's a very, very subtle kind of thing. And it's not until there's been enough intestinal contents that leak out into the peritoneum and actually cause peritoneal irritation and infection that you start getting symptoms from that perforation. So it's not a bleeding out kind of thing. It's a leakage of nasty stuff, causing more nasty stuff that's the problem. So it would be a kid that's coming in with abdominal distension, abdominal pain, possibly some vomiting, with a huge, huge long list of differential diagnosis there. And that would be one of those kind of moments when you do an x-ray and you see a metallic object or two metallic objects down there, and then you really get your answer there. So that's going to be one of those cases where you're going to go, okay, all right, so that's what's causing it.
A relief of like, oh, okay, finally. Because I think abdominal complaints are always some of the hardest things to differentiate sometimes.
Oh, they are.
Especially in the field.
Even in the ER, there are many times when we admit or discharge patients and go, well, I don't know what's causing your pain, but it doesn't seem to be anything, you know, really, really bad. So let's give it a little bit more time and see what happens. Too many things that can go wrong in there.
Yeah, it's always the tough ones. Mm-hmm. All right, let's say, there's also those pretty light bulbs on our Christmas trees.
Mm-hmm.
And mine are I like the old-fashioned big ones.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using power. You know, I'm definitely anti-green with my Christmas. Well, my Christmas tree is green, but anti-green. And they get warm.
Yeah.
They definitely get warm. And children, especially, you know, and our younger toddlers, don't understand the difference between hot and cold. It's kind of an ambiguous term to them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them find out very quickly what hot is.
Yeah, they do.
So we may have burns on those.
Fortunately, you know, well, it's going to be hand burns, finger burns. You know, usually those are not any kind of bad stuff. Sometimes they'll put them in their mouths, and they may get oral burns. Now, fortunately, anything in the mouth tends to heal very, very well. And unless you get a burn because a kid is chomping on an electric cord, which there are plenty of with Christmas trees and lights and things, many more electric cords. Now, there's a classic injury right there, is the chomping down on the electrical cord where the kid gets a burn at the corner of the mouth. And it doesn't really look like much of anything. It scars up and it looks nasty, but you know, it's really relatively benign. But then about a week later, when that scab comes off, the scab pulls off, and at the base of that little ulcer there caused by the burn is the labial artery, and the labial artery becomes injured and bleeds all over the place. I think we may have talked about this at one point, but it's a classic injury where you get a kid who has an electrical burn to the corner of the mouth, seems to be doing fine, scab falls off, and then gets an arterial bleed from the corner of the mouth, and that is a true emergency because it is an arterial bleed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, on that. What about, electrical burns in general, they don't look as severe compared to, you know, the external thermal burns
that you're
have. And, you know, you get the pathway of travel, least resistance on these, and sometimes it goes right through the kid. So exteriorly they look okay, but the inside could very well be a whole nother factor.
Yeah.
In terms of damage. What might we expect with those type of injuries?
Fortunately, you know, they don't happen very often. Household current, if somebody is just chewing on a cord, will give you a little bit of a jolt, but generally isn't going to cause a whole lot of internal injury. So I think we're not so worried about that. You know, I would be more worried about maybe an older kid who's working with an adult on putting up some fancy, you know, electrical displays or something like that, where you might be talking about a little bit more power being involved. But I think just the regular household current kind of stuff, probably not much to worry about.
Excellent. That's always good to know on those, because kids love those little sockets in the walls.
Yeah, they do. And anybody, any household that has young children, or even any household that has young children that visit, even on a periodic basis, so grandparents, you really need to be thinking about childproofing the homes. And like I said, it's not just the homes where they live all the time, but where they may be visiting. So, you know, and any family that is going to be taking relatively small kids to visit someplace, you know, you probably would be a good idea to have a traveling kit that helps you childproof the home where you're going.
That's a good point. And I think I'm going to kind of diverge a little bit. But I think injury prevention is also something that we need to look at in EMS.
Always.
And now, at the scene of the 911 call, when the child just, you know, was injured or sick, is not the time to school the parents, you know, on this. But I think we need to be a little bit proactive. And maybe something to look at, you know, with your agency, promote some injury prevention around the holiday times, you know, about things we've talked about, some educational sessions out there or some flyers out there about some of the injuries and poisonings that we've been talking about. If you go into a home and it's a non-emergency, you know, look at the home and look and see, you know, what could be changed to make it a little bit more childproof, especially if it's a grandparent's home and you see pictures of grandchildren, you know, on the wall. I think the biggest thing that we have around our house are the little covers for the outlets.
Yeah. Very simple stuff like that can make a really big difference.
I always tell people, if you really want to get into it, get down on your hands and knees and crawl around.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. You'd be amazing how many, you know, amazed at how many hazards there are down at that level.
I think the other thing we can definitely look at in terms of is trauma. You're talking about the older kids possibly helping mom, or, you know, dad hang the Christmas lights.
Up on the ladders, putting Santa Claus and the reindeers up on the roof. Yeah, people take risks. You know, they're intent on performing a task, and it's a family kind of event, and everybody wants to play a role. But, you know, we just cannot forget that those are opportunities for injury, not only to the kids but to the adults as well. If they're doing something that they only do once a year, you know, they may not be aware of the safety precautions for themselves or for their kids.
So keep an eye out for that. Now,
yeah, and don't forget the weather too. Now, we don't have to worry about this down in Florida for the most part, but
yeah.
You know, you're putting Santa Claus and the reindeer up on the roof, and the roof is icy, then that's a recipe for problems.
Or even just walking out the front steps. You know, our front steps, we try to keep them as clean as we can, but they are still slippery.
Yep.
And they are concrete steps. So, you know, the feet go out, head goes back, hits the corner of the stoop. We have that quite a bit.
And then you have all those lovely snow sports that are just aching to take out people's ankles and legs and all that kind of good stuff.
I had three broken legs already from the hockey rink.
Yeah.
Hockey arena already. And the good part is, you know, they've really, our guys where we are really proactive in terms of pain management. So kids went down on some good morphine and hopefully feeling nothing on the way down.
Morphine is always good.
For that. I think the other thing is, I don't know how common it is, but as we start to get into the holiday season, we start to have parties. And of course, parties, we have a lot of food being prepared. On these, what about foodborne illnesses?
You have to be careful because there are certain types of food that are more prone to potentially becoming colonized with staph. If you're putting food out for, let's say, you're having an open house, so people might be expected to be coming and going all afternoon and all evening. You really do need to be watching out for the temperature that you're holding your food at. And, you know, different kinds of food require different kinds of temperatures, and there's all different kinds of guidelines for that kind of thing. But it's definitely something to be concerned about.
I think that we probably won't know until maybe the next morning. With the nausea, vomiting, and illness?
Well, as often as early as even 4 hours after, because staph food poisoning can have an onset really pretty quickly afterwards.
Now, how do we start to differentiate between a foodborne illness and the flu?
Very difficult. You can't. And truly, you know, the treatment is pretty much the same anyway. It's the history that's going to lead you to suspect a potential food poisoning kind of scenario. And you might be able to get a history that there are multiple people who have, you know, called up the house and said, hey, did anybody else get sick? You know, since since the party, but yeah, generally the treatment is pretty much the same anyway. So it's more of an academic exercise and also then a public health kind of exercise to find out, you know, how many other people may be affected and is there anything that needs to be done as far as tracking potential sources of the food poisoning. That's more of a commercial kind of problem, but when you're talking about large family and friend gatherings, then, you know, it could be a problem even in that kind of a setting.
Absolutely. Then, of course, with the holidays, we start to see stress, family stress, and child maltreatment.
Yeah, and suicide.
And suicide.
Yeah, there are children who are in school age who are actively suicidal. Now, the psychiatrists generally say that below the age of about six, the kids don't truly have a concept of what they're saying when they say, I want to die. They don't understand that it's permanent and that, you know, they can't change their mind and come back. And so they can't truly be suicidal because they don't understand the consequences. But it's really sad to see the number of young kids who truly are suicidal, really are suicidal. And it's not just the old folks. It's not just those who've lost loved ones. That stress can affect the children as well.
How do we deal with that? I mean, as EMS providers, especially with the teenagers and that age group we get into. And I was just teaching a pediatric course recently, and I was doing the child and family interaction section. And in there is a 16-year-old girl who overdosed on Tylenol and stuff. And the callousness by some of the responders towards that was kind of disheartening. And more so the younger responders than the older ones. How do we stop that? You know, how do we get that through, the empathy that they need to have in a situation?
Well, I think people need to understand that depression is an illness, just the same as asthma, just the same as, coronary artery disease. And as such, the suicidal thoughts, the suicidal attempts are symptoms of a disease. And these people have very little more control over what they're doing than does someone who's having a heart attack or who may be having an asthma attack. And we need to get it out of our heads that these acts and these thoughts are something that are completely under the control of the person that they're occurring to. It's a chemical problem. There is some, you know, conscious control that can be exerted when there's appropriate intervention, but gosh, you know, good mental health resources are, number one, hard to find, and number two, hard to afford. And then particularly when you're talking about pediatric mental health resources, the kids just are not getting the help that they need. So they're having to deal with it on their own, with their families, with their friends, with their pastors, whoever. And, you know, it's just not enough. And it is very easy to be kind of callous, particularly when it's, you know, a kid who may be showing signs of, being disrespectful of authority and just in general not behaving in a very socially acceptable way. It's very easy to just be callous about that and just, you know, blame the kid for the way that they're acting, but the way they're acting is a reaction to what's going on in their entire life. And I try to view it as a symptom of an illness, as something that they cannot necessarily control, and that they probably have not had access to resources to be able to help them control it. So therefore, any opportunity that I have to help them is a great opportunity to give them something that they may not have had access to before. So you got to view them as human beings, basically. Put yourself in their shoes. And it's easy to say, oh, I would never do that. Well, I think most people who get to the point of having suicidal ideation never thought that they would get to that point.
Absolutely. Great point. Great point on that. Now, I think we're any other thoughts there, Dr. Lou? Anything we should else think more about in terms of the holiday season and children?
Well, you did talk about child abuse, and you know, the economic climate has caused a lot of stress, especially these last few years. And the holiday season is a financial stressor big time, even more than other parts other parts of the year. So, yeah, there could be a bump up in child abuse. And in an atmosphere where everybody is supposed to be happy and you know, full of goodwill toward men and all that kind of stuff, when you see someone who has acted with ill will, it just hits that much harder, and it can be very, very difficult to deal with on a daily basis. But, you know, in a holiday setting, even worse. You know, again, you just need to take it a patient at a time and try to focus on the kid, not on the perpetrator. Focus on what you can do for the child and do for the family, because remember, we cannot judge who it was that the perpetrators were. And even if it was a family member or someone close to the family who was the perpetrator, that entire family has been affected. So it's not just the child, but it's also the people who love the child that are our responsibility to begin treatment for. So, you know, we need to remain professional, keep our reactions off to the side, and, you know, work our way through that once we're no longer with the patient and the family. But just really concentrate on what we can do for that kid.
That's a good point. I think we should close out with two conditions that are very close to me on this. And I'm sure it affects probably thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of children every Christmas night. And that is of the candy cane overdose and the cookie hangover for that. And you know, how do we deal with those?
Let them run it out.
Run it out. As they're laying there moaning and groaning in the pile of paper, Christmas paper and empty boxes, and mom and dad are sitting there. And I always go back to my favorite Christmas movie, which runs 24 hours a day, A Christmas Story.
Uh-huh.
And the post-opening of presents when they're all sitting there, all tired and all just relaxing in the middle of it, all in the glow. So I think with that one, folks, we are going to close out this edition of the PDU podcast, our holiday edition. Merry Christmas, everybody. Dr. Lou, where can folks find you?
Oh, I am at my website at jumpstarttriage.com, or you can email me at Lou Romig, that's LOUROMIG, at bellsouth.net.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me for this festive edition of the PDU podcast.
Always a pleasure. Happy holidays, everyone.
And happy holidays, everyone. Once again, this is Kyle David Bates. You can find me at kyledavidbates.com, at pd-u.com. You can find me over at my other project, as firstfewmoments.com, which we'll be recording our holiday edition there, which will be released. And I'll just give you a hint. It involves a high-profile crash involving many small individuals, one bariatric patient, and nine livestock. So tune over to that one. On that. So for myself and Dr. Lou, have a very safe, joyful, and careful holiday season out there. And we look forward to hearing from you on our next podcast. Give us a call at 716-245-5336. We'd love to hear your comments on that. So we'll talk to y'all later. I'm gonna hold on to you as long